Hello and welcome back to the latest episode of the Master of None podcast. I am Stephen, your host as always, and I'm joined by Westy. Sam may or may not be dropping in. We don't know. His schedule is busier than ours, so he might be dropping in. We'll see. But we do have Westy here to start off. So Westy, how are you, bud?
I'm pretty good, yeah. At least I'm not a loser at responsibilities like Sam, you know. Hate that life.
These kids really slow you down, yeah, right? They really do.
How are you supposed to be selfish when you have to raise a family? It's just, it's unreasonable, really, you know.
I know. That's one of my big drawbacks, having kids. Yeah. What if I can't do what I want? You know what I mean?
I had a great weekend without kids. You know, I managed to watch 4 rugby matches on Saturday, which was really, really fun for me. We had a few pints on Friday night. We watched the Ireland game. Went running Saturday morning to run off those pints. And then, yeah, Saturday and Sunday, just enjoyed St. Bridget's Day. Just celebrating, you know, St. Bridget. And, you know, taking off cloaks and putting them on the ground. That's just what I do on Bridget's Day, you know?
I was going to ask that question. That's St. Bridget, right? She had the, she's like, throw whatever land it covers is yours, and she threw out this massive, well, she threw out a small thing, but it started to expand.
Fantastic. Right? That's, yeah, that's exactly it, yeah. So she was told she could build a church on whatever land her cloak could cover, and her cloak covered a massive area.
Her cloak was expanding foam, you know, that foam that when you spray it, it just like triples in size.
It was like one of those, I used to buy the little aliens or little dinosaurs in the goo, and then like they were supposed to grow, but they just like absorbed whatever was in it. And then, that's what her coat was made of.
God, we're so up to date with our religious saints.
Yeah, I think the church is in Kildare, isn't it?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, that's definitely Leinster, I know that. Because why would you want to build something anywhere else, you know? Back then, it was just Leinster, really. It was a good weekend, right? It was quiet bank holiday weekend, which is nice. Friday night, we did go for a few pints and watch the game. Went to the Tatch here in Oranmore. We haven't been since it reopened. Or I hadn't, I don't know, maybe you've been. I haven't been since it reopened. So it was good to get in, because I'd heard kind of mixed reports. So we enjoyed it, though. I thought it was pretty good. Bar the really loud group of women that sat beside us. And if you're listening, you know who you are. Just unnecessarily loud. I just don't get it. But look it. I suppose everyone's barometer of sound is different. Mine's quite low. I think that's what I've learned over the years, is that I don't have much of a tolerance for it.
I think that's why you don't stay in pubs to watch matches. You know, we left the pub to go to Sam's house to watch the match. And that's not why we left. The plan was always to leave. But, you know, you prefer to watch it in a contained environment.
It depends, like, yeah, for a Six Nations game. Now, again, last round, and it's maybe a Grand Slam decider. Like, last year we watched it in a pub, and it was great, because that's an event kind of thing, you know? And the same with South Africa, the South Africa game in the World Cup group stage. I watched that in Murty Rabbits, because I was like, I wanted to be a part of that atmosphere. But 9 times out of 10, I want to be able to, like, listen to the TV, listen to the, listen to the commentators, but that's not sometimes always the best, but... What mainly it's useful for is, like, if someone's down injured, what's the injury, you know, what happened, TMO, stuff like that. That's where it's really useful. But that was fun. We had a good crack with that. And then, yeah, we'll have to do another last day Six Nations Murty Rabbits marathon like we did last year.
Yeah.
Which actually was really, really fun. I really enjoyed that.
Super Saturday, man. It's a great event. It kind of comes across a little bit in the Six Nations documentary on Netflix, but, like... I remember Super Saturdays more than I remember, like, specific Six Nations. Like, I remember one in Dublin where Sam came to the house and we were watching it last year at Murty Rabbits. You know, it's great. It's always great. And even as Sam said last week, like, it's great when there's something on the line. So even, you know, France won last year. So, you know, if England beat us and we got nothing, they won on Super Saturday is what I mean. And then if we had taken nothing from the Indian game, they would have won the Six Nations. So, like, I love that great bit of tension that's added by all 3 games but on the same day. Like, it's great.
It is great. And actually, we finished the Six Nations doc last night. I totally forgot about Freddie Stewart's red card in that game. And I think I was probably pissed off at the time. I don't think it was a red card. I'm going to stand by that. I think that was a yellow. And I'm annoyed that was even a thing in the game. I also forgot how
it was overturned, wasn't it? I think.
It was overturned, yeah, yeah. I think that was a harsh red card. But I also tweeted, and this is, we'll actually get talking about rugby soon. I also tweeted that I was just shocked by the amount of coaches that brought up the fact that Ireland was the number one team in the world every time before they played them. And like, someone tweeted back, like, yes, but they were the number one team in the world. I'm not denying that part. I'm just saying that A, those rankings can fluctuate so quickly. So it's not like, you know, it was like when New Zealand was number one in the world for God knows how long. I'm like, okay, fair enough. But Ireland hadn't held that pedestal for too long, I don't think. It was after they beat New Zealand in November, wasn't it? Or that series, I think, that they gained the number one spot.
It was either that or when we beat South Africa.
Yeah, it was a couple of months max.
We held it for about a year, I think, anyway.
Yeah, until the World Cup, pretty much, wasn't it?
Yeah.
But it was just, especially Gregor Townsend, and even when the Italy game, he was his first thing he said about Italy was, this is the best Italy team we've probably ever played. And like, maybe I'm reading too much into it, but he's almost like highlighting the other teams. He's putting them on a pedestal almost, but rather than maybe bringing his own team up to a certain... I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm reading too much into it, but it was just... I find it bewildering how often they were saying it.
Part of that's got to be direction as well. Like, they need to build the tension in each episode when they're playing as Ireland, I have to say it. But it's also, like, how do you get a Scotland team up for an Ireland game, a game that they play every year? You know, you need to have something different, some other different, like, note to have. So it's like, these guys are number one in the world. Like, you know, if you take these guys down, you give yourself a great shot. You know, you put yourself in a great position going into the World Cup, or at least mentally, because, you know, the world rankings don't mean fuck all outside of a draw for the World Cup. So more so mentally, you put yourself in a great position. You know, going into the next game, you know, you take a lot of confidence from that. Like, you know, you can say, look, Ireland beating South Africa took a lot of confidence going forward, but a lot of bloody good it did us. But yeah, but there you go. New Zealand beating us took a lot of confidence forward to the semi-final. Now, it wasn't an overly challenging game against Argentina, but took that confidence forward to a great final. So, yeah, I think if you build up your opponent and you win, you gain more than if you push them down and beat them. You don't want your players going to be complacent going into an Italy game, especially, you know, because that's when they will catch you.
Yeah, no, it's a fair point. Also, never thought I'd see Stuart Hogg on a horse. So, you know, there was, yeah, we're constantly learning something.
Is there anything in the fact that he's a farmer and his last name is Hogg?
I mean, yeah.
Nobody
hair.
Mentioned that in the,
Hey, what a poster boy for hair transplants, by the way. Unbelievable. How well that stuck. But yeah, I was shocked that he was only 30 last year. Just assumed he was older. But again, that's how bad is. I know, and his body is just so broken. So yeah, that was disappointing. But before we also get stuck in, we do have a Fantasy Six Nations League that we started last week. 68 people have joined, which is great. Thank you for everyone. If you still want to join, like Sam, who didn't join, what a host he is. It's on my Twitter. It's I can retweet it again this week. But I will name at the top five. Shockingly enough, Westy, me and you are not in the top five. I'm 38 and you are 60th. Now it is tight, as in, you know, there's not a ton of points between everybody, but I'm just, I suppose, glad to be beating you.
Ironic, I usually start well and then spend the rest of the season plummeting down through the rankings. So it's nice that I've started where I'm going to finish this time.
Yeah, maybe you might, you know, kick on. In fifth, we have three teams tied for third. So we have Miguel Vidal, which is just a fantastic name, if that's actually your name. We have Lewin, I think it's pronounced, L-E-U-A-N. In tied third, and then Anne and Owen's combined 15. They're all tied on third place with 411 points. Or Turner is on second place with 415. And out in front on 419 points is Bottom But Not For Long, which is a good play on Furlong's name there. I do enjoy a good name. Fiondiaki there in seventh as well, which is Fionn. That's quality too. Good to have the Fantasy back. I have a love-hate relationship with Fantasy Sports, but this was, it is kind of fun, actually. Also, before we move on, Westy chose, he went to the scrap heap for his substitute, his sub, I don't know what they're called, super sub, Ben Healy. And how many points did that get you, Westy?
A whole lot of nothing.
A whole lot of nothing, except shame. Shame.
If Scotland hadn't completely capitulated, they might have taken Finn Russell off with half an hour to go, and then Ben Healy would have had plenty of time to build up the score. Like, everything was going great until Thomas Williams came on.
I'd say Ben Healy was at halftime. He was like, I might get 35 minutes. I might get at least 30. Okay, let's go into the games. We'll start with Italy and England. We'll get that game sort of maybe out of the way a little bit, because It was really a classic Italy kind of game, wasn't it? Because they started really, really well. I was watching that first half, and they played some really nice rugby. That Tommaso Allan try, especially, was... Now, it was probably poor defence, but it was still beautiful. Hands, lovely little loop pass out the back. Johnny Sexton is gone, but never forgotten. Every loop play I see, I just see him shining down. He's not dead, but you know what I mean. Lovely rugby. But then, you know, I think we were saying in the WhatsApp, it was like... I said it was like watching Connacht a lot of times, because it was like restarts. Italy were kicking themselves in the foot. Silly penalties given away. And I will say, credit to England. They really won this game by taking their 3 points when it was presented to them. I think they tried once to go for the corner. And in fairness, Italy really held up well in defence, especially on the goal line. And they just said to take the 3 points. And I think it saved them in the long run. They got themselves clear enough in that second half that Italy, despite a late try and a brilliant try, from Ione, they held on by 3 points. But I don't know. Let's talk about Italy first, Westy. Your beloved Italy. How did you rate their performance?
I was wearing my Italy vest that someone got me for either Christmas or a birthday. I can't remember. How do I rate it? Overall, disappointing. I caveat it by it is a new coach and it's a new system. It's going to take a while to bed. I thought the tries that they scored were brilliant. They're all off great counter-attacks. They're all off a relatively poor England kicking game where they were able to catch the ball, fleece it wide and get around them and run into that space that was left. I think that defensively, I'm kind of in two minds about the defense, right? Because yes, they held England out. So sorry, defensively, they've definitely improved, right? You know, they conceded nearly 200 points in two games in the World Cup against France and New Zealand. But discipline-wise, they haven't really improved. Even early on, they give away the first penalty. They give away these penalties that let kind of George Ford build England back into the game. And then they were masters of that. I mean, even in the first half, I think the only time they didn't take points from an entry to England into Italy's 22 was just before the end of the half, where Italy managed to turn it over and kick it out. I think like even like there are still moments of terrible defending. I mean, he's only young, so I don't want to throw him in the scrap heap, as you would say, but Asante Garibisi's turn for the first England try, it's just awful defending. Like he goes well before there's any dummy of a pass. He just assumes the pass is coming and keeps pushing wide and then slot right through, and then it's a great bit of hands to score in the corner. I think it's Freeman who breaks, and then the Daly scores in the corner. But there's a lot of signs of improvement in Italy. Now the problem with this is like it's similar, as you said, to maybe a Connacht situation. There's only so long you can pat them on the back and say, God, they're almost there against England. It's not the best England team we've ever seen. It's an England team getting to grips with a new system, with a new defence coach as well in Felix Jones. And Italy, for the most part, were able to capitalise that, but they weren't able to maintain it. I was actually shocked with kind of how lethargic is the wrong word. It's too strong, but the kind of lack of fire that they came out of the dressing rooms with in the second half. Like they really... Like I think, what do they have? Like, I think in the first 20 minutes or half an hour, second half, they had something like 17% possession. Like, there's a stat that I read on Sunday. So that was really disappointing. But I'm going to go the opposite of what a lot of people have said, in that, like, oh, they only scored at the end. What I love is the fact that there are players like Monte Ioni in that squad who are going to say, this is not over until it's effing over. They started on their own try line and they went up the pitch and scored at the end and got losing bonus point. They're not going to win the you know, I've heard people say they're not going to win, so what's a losing bonus point going to do? It might help them avoid a wooden spoon at the end, you know? Like, it is important for Italy in their growth to start taking points from these games. They have a really... The core group of that squad is quite young, right? There's kind of some older players in there as well in their late 20s, early 30s, but the Garibisi brothers are early 20s. You've got Michele Lamro, still quite young. You've got the Calone brothers are, well, young-ish, 27, 28. Rusa, I think, is 28, 29. So you worry how long they can be thereabouts and not get it. Like, these losses will grate on you. And again, losing is a habit as much as winning is a habit is. But to take historically one of the strongest teams in the Six Nations, they've probably won the Six Nations the most in the last 10 years, to take them, I'm going to say essentially to the last minutes of the game, you know, to be competitive with them, to stay in the fight. And that's something I've criticized Italy about so much over the last years. My old line of not playing the last 20 minutes. they stayed in the fight and even managed to take something from it. So I think you have to give them a little bit of leeway. Like, this is the tide coming in, you know, the wave comes in and it pulls back out, then it comes in a bit and it pulls back out. With the new coach, that wave is going to pull back out a little bit until they get set in the systems that they're playing. But I'm optimistic for the development of Italy. It's a long bloody way from shipping almost 100 points to New Zealand 6 months ago.
Yeah, you make a great point. That's the one I want to talk about as well. And it was clear in the Six Nations documentary. It was, you know, every game ended with Sebastian Negri being like, we showed a lot of fight, and you know, I feel like we've, you know, progressed. And it's like, yeah, well, you're still losing by double digits a lot. You know what I mean? And there's only so much you can do. So I think they look back and think that was a really, really winnable game, and it was a really winnable game. England didn't show a ton, and you're at home. You have to try and make Rome a bit of a fortress, or at least a shitty place to go. And to be up at half time playing pretty well, and as I said, not going up against a great team, that's a game you have to be looking to win if you're an Italy team. And again, yes, there's a new coach in. Who's slick looking, by the way. He's just up in the stadium, up in the crowd with a suit on, baller. But they have to. Yeah, there's only. I think when you have every game is like a, we tried our best and you know we gave it our all. It's almost like that becomes your expectation of it almost. And rather than now, obviously you can't, you know, throw a hissy fit and slam tables and whatever after every loss because you're gonna be out a lot of tables. The budget for Italian rugby is gonna be through the roof, but. You still have to be, because again, like France and Ireland, you're not going to look as a potential scalp. Wales is your only last one, but now you've almost put pressure on that game of being like, God, we have to win that game to avoid another wooden spoon. And can we stop saying wooden spoon, by the way? Because watching that Six Nations documentary, I was like, even I was questioning, I was like, are teams presented with an actual wooden spoon? Because it was such a like, it kept saying the wooden spoon as if it existed. And I was just like, it's just last place. Like, I don't know, but that's a different discovery or a different discussion for a different day. But yeah, disappointed that they couldn't get that win again, just because of how, as you said, England are still so much in their infancy. They didn't play well, and you only lost by 3 points, and you probably gave away what 9 points to Ford that were sort of silly penalties. Defensively, as you said, for that try for Elliot Daly was poor. So again, I feel like we are talking about cons sometimes, but I'm like, if you can just eliminate two of those mistakes, boom, you've beaten England at home, and you know, and you deserve to probably, and that's the really, really disheartening part for an Italian team. But
One other thing about them, and like it frustrates me. It frustrated me in the first half when they were playing really well. They still do this thing, like they don't play the whistle. And this has been a running theme in Italy for the last couple of years. I don't know if it's always been a running theme, but like even, like for one of the for okay, first off, I think Alex Mitchell was tackled. He is held and on the ground, and you know that's a tackle. But people kind of seem to like just watch him get up and run over the line, or. When the ball is overthrown on the line out, Brex kind of catches it on the volley and then just stands and watches it bounce to the touch. And it's like even if you batted it down with your hand, just play the whistle, play on, like you never know what's going to happen. And I feel like if even if they and they're playing that style of rugby, which is the worst part, they're playing this expansive, exciting brand to watch of moving the ball, you have to play the whistle. Like it's really frustrating, as you said. One play of the whistle or getting rid of one or two mistakes, and they won that game.
And that's like people will say like that's coaching. That's not coaching. Like if me and you were substituting that game, we wouldn't do that. Now it would be crap at all the other stuff, but we wouldn't stop playing because we didn't hear a whistle. Like we just wouldn't do that. That's something that you're told when you are a child growing up playing rugby. I'm sure. Again, I didn't grow up playing rugby, but it's the same in every sport. You play the bloody whistle, and that's all that matters. So that's again, I suppose, frustrating. Italy now, they are, oh yeah, they're coming to Dublin next weekend. They won't be probably eyeing that up as a scalp, but I mean, strange things have happened. Italy tend to, especially last year, Ireland definitely didn't play their best against Italy. They rarely actually do put up a hammering of Italy. So it'll be interesting to see if that happens again on Sunday, but we'll get to that maybe in a second.
The only other thing I would say, I think it's unfortunate for Leeds to have Ireland next away because that could be disheartening. I'm not saying we're definitely going to beat them or we're definitely going to put points on them, but like I'm saying, it has the potential to be a heavy loss. I think the Scotland game, you know, they were there thereabouts against Scotland last year. we saw Scotland capitulate against Wales at the weekend, which we'll get onto, but that and the Wales games could be realistic targets for them, especially the fact that Scotland is in Rome. But it's unfortunate that they get through us in the middle. They'll have a week off, but it could take away a lot of the good that they might be able to take away from this weekend against England.
Yeah, and the France the weekend after as well. So yeah, you'd be looking at those last two weekends maybe at causing an upset, but as you said, what will the confidence levels be like after the next two weekends? But moving on then, we had one of the best worst games possibly in the last couple of years. Wales Scotland coming out 1 point victors, leading 20-0 at half time. Scotland were away to Wales in Principality Stadium, and Wales score 26 unanswered points in the second half, and Scotland though score try and hold on, but sorry, they may not score 26 on this, I can't remember what it was, but they totally dominated the second half, 26-7. And I mean, we do say the old cliche of a game of two halves, but Jesus Christ, this really was the dictionary definition of that cliche. Let's talk about the first half. Westy, were Wales really, really bad, or were Scotland really, really good, or was there a mixture of both in that first half? How did Scotland come out 20-0 at halftime?
I think it's a mixture of both. I think Scotland's counterattack was really strong, whereas Wales did this thing that is a hack of the law, where you don't have to actually retreat when you kick. You can stand perfectly still and wait for the ball carrier to advance 5 meters. I actually thought they changed that a few years ago to that you physically had to retreat, but apparently that's not the point, not the rule. But the fact that
Jackman was talking about it, it's the DuPont law, I think he called it. So if you stand still, or if the player passes it, you're onside.
Okay, it's a pass as well. I didn't realize that was the case.
Pass, or if he runs 5 meters and you stay still, he's onside, I think. Now, maybe they're looking at changing it, but who knows?
I watched it on BBC and the Welsh commentators were given out of them for just stand there. And I think, while I see that there is logic in what you're doing, I think Scotland were so good in the counter-attack, they were just able to gain momentous territory by either running it back or kicking it back and then chasing it and shutting them down. I'm not sure what their end goal was from that. I understand to keep players in a better position and conserve energy, but it's only really going to work if you're really ready to pounce on the ball once the player passes. You're then accelerating and chasing or runs 5 meters. I thought Scotland's counterattack was really good. I thought Finn Russell looked really confident. I mean, if we're only talking about the first half, I thought Kyle Rowe was going to be like, I was like, oh, what an introduction to international rugby. This guy's going to be unreal. I thought he was having a fantastic game. That's not going to last into the second half, by the way, just to warn you. I think Wales were very narrow in defence, and Scotland are very good at moving the ball. I mean, Hugh Jones and Tupou had a fantastic partnership last year. It looked like that was going to continue into this year. I think more so in the first half, Wales looked awful, and Scotland were very, very good at identifying problems and capitalising on them.
Yeah, I think, yeah, it was almost... I can't think of the perfect storm where Scotland, you said, everything that they tried really clicked. Wales were shocking, and it looked like it was like, oh, Gatland, you know, another nightmare start for Gatland. It's a really young squad. I think what they have, like one or two players over 30 years old, I think they're the youngest squad, I think, by a good bit in the Six Nations.
Yeah.
And it looked like that, and you're like, oh my God, the poor confidence of this squad now. You know, what if this turns out to be 50 points from Scotland in the game? And I don't know what was said at half time, but Wales came out a different team, and talk about, you know, momentum in sport. Like, Wales just got on a roll, and everything, as you said, clicked. Wainwright was on fire there for a good 10-15 minutes. Everything he touched turned to gold, and Scotland had no answer for it. And it was so weird that, I know, maybe this is an oversight or an overreaction by me, but is this where, like, having the likes of Finn Russell as your captain doesn't work? Because Finn Russell isn't a player necessarily that I think you would look to when shit is hitting the fan to look for as an example, because that's not who he is. He's Finn Russell, and that's brilliant, and there's a lot of pros to that. But one of the cons maybe is, like, when the chips are down, do I look to Finn Russell to get us out of that? I wouldn't, whereas I would look at a Peter O'Mahony, I would look at Alan Wynne-Jones back in the day, those kind of leaders. And Finn Russell's very much a different leader. He's more of a do as I say rather than I do. But I think Scotland really missed a player there in that second half to just say, like, here's what we need to do to slow this, you know, rolling boulder down this hill and just breathe for a second. And they didn't seem to have that. Is that harsh criticism of Finn Russell maybe in Scotland as well?
No, I think that's a really good point. I think that's probably one of the reasons they went with vice captains when they picked their squad and didn't name an out-and-out captain. It isn't uncommon as well. Usually you have a pack leader in a game like that. So when you are getting rolled in a rolling mull, there's someone there to say, right, this is what we're going to do. We're just going to fucking tie in and lock and, help you kind of get set. Or, sometimes teams do where, like, especially in a scrum or a set, like you call like set or like down or bind, every couple of seconds just to keep sure make sure everybody is on song. But yeah, it almost seemed too easy at one point for the Welsh rolling mall to get through. It's really funny because this was my third game of the day, my fourth game in 24 hours. And like when Doohan scored the first try in the second half, like my phone came out. Like I was kind of like starting to like, oh, I better do this and that. And I've run through bits around the house here, but I put on this wash now because I have a few clothes to. And then like they got the first try and you're like, oh, Jesus, yeah, good. And the yellow card, you're like, okay, they might get another one in now. And then they got the other one. And then there was another yellow card. You're like, oh dear God! Like it was a really, really impressive comeback from Wales. So I don't think you can put all of the onus on. I don't think it's Finn Russell. It's definitely not Finn Russell's fault that things fell apart because it was very much a forward problem. But yeah, maybe they lacked a voice within that squad. Maybe that is the likes of a Magnus Bradbury or a Hamish Watson who's been better at that over the last few years. I don't know the inner workings. I know Jamie Ritchie was captain, so maybe it falls on him. But maybe they were missing players that normally help bind that pack, because the Welsh rolling mall just seemed to work too well. And no more than Italy in the England game, they just let Wales play a territory game. I don't remember there's 20 minutes in that game, I don't remember Scotland touching the ball. It's apart from the kickoff. Again, not blaming Finn Russell for the fall apart, but maybe they are lacking leadership in other areas of the pitch, which again is quite funny because it's not that dramatically changed of a Scotland squad. A lot of these players have been together for a long time. I know there's new players in, but it's not a massive overhaul. Like maybe you see with an England team where it is quite a different starting 15 than we said, five debutants, I think, in a game against Italy. It's disappointing maybe that they weren't able to ride that. It was really impressive, again, that they did turn it around-ish and were camped on the Wales line then the last minute and almost got another try to push it ahead. Like a really worrying 30 minutes where there's, or 25 minutes where there was two yellow cards and just free fall completely of the Scotland game plan.
But then on the flip side, Wales got back to that game by throwing caution to the wind a little bit, running it from deep and being a bit, off script a little bit. And then when they got back to within a point, they stopped doing all the stuff that got them back into that game. And you could see that they were going back to a more classic kind of game style and trying to basically get Scotland to concede a penalty in their own, 22 or half and then kick the 3 points. But that literally was what Scotland needed to stop that momentum. They got the ball back. Wales kept kicking the ball to them. And it's a classic example of you stop doing the stuff that got you back into the game. And if I was a Wales fan, I'd be so disappointed because you did. Like, literally, you were, as I said, that the wave of momentum Scotland could not stop. And you were, they almost, as I jokingly said on the radio show I do, it's like they almost scored too soon. As in, like, there was still like 7 or 8 minutes left. And it was like, oh, if this was like, 5 minutes later, it would have been probably better because they would have just thrown, again, caution to the wind. But they did. Did you notice that too? They just stopped doing what they had done the previous 20 minutes to get back into the game and then became a typical boring rugby side again.
It's high risk, high return rugby, isn't it? Like that got them back in the game. So I guess once they had a sniff of winning it, they were kind of more concerned with getting territory and getting in a position where a penalty. I suppose they were thinking about the penalty and not the try, because I mean they had the bonus point. They scored 4 tries. They were, they only needed a penalty to win it. So, and we talked about it before in a podcast where, teams' game plans change once they're inside the 22 or once they're inside the 10-meter line because you move to a more conservative game rather than trying these big, massive passes because you've worked to get into the territory that you want. But yeah, I did think it was funny. I think they took their foot off the gas a little bit. I don't know if it was a drastic, I don't know if I interpreted it as much of a drastic change as you did. I do think they took their foot off the gas and changed side a little bit, and that allowed Scotland to kind of take a deep breath and kind of, not necessarily get back into the game because there wasn't enough time for that, but, you know, take some semblance of control back of the game.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think Welsh fans and the Welsh squad, I think it's pretty obvious that they will take positives from that game. Obviously, the first half was pretty bad, but to show the character and drive, especially from a young squad, to come back and nearly win it is huge. As a Scottish fan, Westy, how do you feel? Because obviously you get the win. You know, at the end of the day, that's all that really matters. You got the win. You're still on for a championship, but your team looked very, very ordinary for 30 minutes there. Again, to a fairly poor overall Welsh team. How do you take more positives than negatives from that result, or how do you react to that if you were a Scottish fan?
Look, if you're a Scottish fan, you're happy that you beat Wales and Cardiff for the first time in 20-odd years. If you're a Scottish player, though, this is where I think the damage is. You know, you'll take confidence because you created those chances, but like it's a pretty big scare. And now you have France coming to town, is it on Saturday? I think, or is it Friday, Saturday, isn't it? You have France coming to town, and France will be a wounded animal. France will want to put a marker down and show that they're, you know, they've been getting a bit of abuse, World Cup hangover talk and all that. They'll want to show that they can still play rugby. And, you know, Scotland will take, there's a risk of Scotland taking a mental scar from this, which, as you said, the Welsh team will go into next weekend, been like, lads, we can score when we play rugby. Look at what we did. Whereas, you know, if the Scotland team goes behind early on against France, I think there could be a big problem because, it's kind of a bad lesson learned, or, you know, it's kind of scar tissue is what I mean, in that if the wheels start to come off, it's like, you know, don't know what's happening again type thing.
Yeah, you mentioned Scotland host France, which does mean, though, we get our first flower of Scotland in Murrayfield. And, you know, that heals my soul, Westy. Right, last game to talk about, which ironically was the first game. France and Ireland, a great way to kick off the Six Nations. Very, very highly anticipated game. And Ireland come out on top by 21 points, 38 points to 17, which I don't think anyone saw coming. Especially, I know we said last week, I think we said France would win. I actually had changed my mind, I think, by the time the game came around. I put up a poll on Twitter, and France were I think it was like 55-45 in favour of France from everyone that voted. But it wasn't to be. Ireland looked like basically they haven't missed a beat from the World Cup. It looked like the exact same team that had gone unbeaten for so long and only lost one game in whatever it was, 17 or 18. Which is impressive considering the player that they lost. Like, Sexton was so vital and so involved in everything, and to replace him with Jack Crowley, who's still so inexperienced and, you know, at times looked at on Friday night, but still so talented, to go away to France, albeit not in Paris, but in wherever, Marseille it was, and to be as clinical and to be as efficient and just as, you know, the well-oiled machine that they've become over the last 2 years, and to put 38 points in that French team, albeit down a man, which we'll talk about. It was really impressive, wasn't it, Wesley? Like, again, I wasn't expecting them to be a totally different team or anything like that, but, you know, Joe McCarthy starting, Calvin Nash starting, there was potential there for a team that didn't look as you know, the continuity wouldn't have been as high as the team that played New Zealand, and that would have been fair to expect, but they looked like they just hit the ground running. And that first 10 minutes, it was obvious that this team, you know, were here to cause a bit of an upset, which is crazy to say, but they looked super, super impressive.
Yeah, I think so. I think you're right about, like, they started the game with intent. And just to go back on a couple of points that you made, like, look, you can tell yourself whatever you want now. I don't think anybody thought we were going to win it by that much. Now, look, the red card is a talking point. It's going to play a part in it. But I do want to point out that my prediction was Ireland Grand Slam last week. Now, I only did it to be different. So I will take that.
So far, so good, Westy. So far, so good.
It's also, I mean, everyone's talking about Grand Slam hopes now, but it is still really areas of big competition to go. There'll be changes. There'll be, you know, there'll be teams growing in confidence and teams losing confidence and all that. I kind of, I guess I downplayed Sexton been missing last week now, because you and Sam talked about Sexton missing. When you asked me, I said there wasn't that much change in the wider squad. You know, most of that squad is, apart from actually McCarthy and Nash, are both new players in as well. But what I really liked to see, and it's something that I was thinking about later on in the week, when you go back and look, most of Sexton's passes are short, right? Like Sexton feeds to the pod and then loops around and gets it and then maybe skips somebody out. But we've seen that backline of Ireland grow quite a lot over the last few years with the involvement of Lowe and Hansen and with these what I call the roaming wingers. You know, we've seen Lowe sitting back in the pocket to give the left boot, or we've seen Matt come in a first receiver to, you know, in various spaces. We've seen Bundy distribute. We've seen props come in and stand in decoy lines and pop back in. So as much as I do think Ireland have been reliant on Sexton for a long time, it's clear that the responsibilities have been divided up between other players. I think Gibson Park had a great game, first of all. I think having a nine that's so confident and so comfortable helps take a lot of the pressure off the shoulders of Jack Crowley. I think Jack Crowley had a really, really good game. There's lots of room for him now to grow as well and to take on his extra responsibilities and kind of help shape that back line as he grows. But I think it was a huge effort in most of the squad in stepping into various other roles and taking that pressure off Crowley. And that's not a criticism on him necessarily, but just on the fact that you've got somebody new in such a pivotal position. But yeah, we started with intent and we kept going. I think I've been debating whether I'd say this or not, but I think we definitely got the bounce of the ball at times. I think now you can put that down to whatever you want. Like, the best luck in the world is preparation. You know, we all know that. So we just looked really on form. We looked like we were able to shake off the New Zealand result and continue on. We knew how close we were to win it and we were fine with that. Whereas maybe for France, it's been slightly more difficult because there was a lot more pressure on them in the World Cup. But I think we looked like a comfortable team with one or two changes. We looked like a team. We looked like the same team we've looked at every Six Nations over the last, maybe since COVID, last 2 or 3 years, where there's one or two changes every year, but it's essentially the same core group, the same core philosophy, and the same game plan that is working for us.
Yeah, just you mentioned about taking the pressure off Crowley. We noticed that watching the game, Bundy was first receiver a couple of times, and that was brilliant to see because the trust in Bundy, but it's great to see that they're not just throwing Crowley in at the deep end. Because again, going away to France for your opening, you know, Six Nations game, that's not easy. Like, French crowds are they're tough to play
intense
in front of, for sure. Intense, yeah. Abrasive was another good word I was trying to find. But they were brilliant. I can't remember I was going to say another point there. I've forgotten it now. But yeah. Let's talk about Joe McCarthy. Like, super, super impressive. I think he got man of the match, didn't he? Or player of the match, whatever it's called now.
Yeah, player of the match.
And he's just, like, he's a generational, I'm not going to say talent yet because we don't really know fully, but in terms of an athlete and a build of a player that you want, especially in that position, he is exactly what you're looking for, where he has that extra size that a Tadhg Byrne or a James Ryan doesn't have, but he's probably faster than them as well. Do you know what I mean? And as comfortable on the ball as them. And that's a player that we don't normally develop. We normally develop great second rows, but they tend to be a couple of kgs lighter than their opposition, especially when it comes to a France or an England or a other Southern Hemisphere teams. And he's not that. He is that level. And it's fantastic to see. It's, again, a testament to that Irish team that he can come in and be so seamlessly introduced and put in a position to succeed rather than, like, we need you to do this. It's probably like, here's what you do well. Let us put you in positions to do that. And it was brilliant to see. And again, Calvin Nash had a pretty easy game in terms of his responsibilities, but again, they put him in good positions. They put him out wide in the wing, and he dots over for his try, and it's great to see. And the reaction of the squad to him scoring was fantastic. And I said to you guys on Friday night, like, again, Andy Farrell just deserves all the credit in the world for setting up this squad and the atmosphere around it, the mindset of the players. It's just incredible to see. I think there'll be, like, studies or documentaries on sports psychology done about this Irish team in a couple of years, because, like, after the game, everyone's just so calm. There's no major highs, there's no major lows. And we mentioned that after the quarterfinal loss, like the lads getting on the plane on the way home, taking the mick out of Johnny Sexton, like, come on up and say hello to him, you know, he loves that. And, like, they had an agonising defeat 2 days before that or a day before that. And you wouldn't have known by their attitudes and their the way they were acting. And I just thought that was a big thing that I noticed at the time. I was like, God, I feel like, you know, the Irish team 4 years before that, the loss, were devastated for like 2 or 3 weeks. Do you know what I mean? That, like, it was just heartbreaking for them. But they know that that's sport and only one team can win on the day. And again, like, that's a big win away from home. Now, I think the scoreline flatters Ireland. I think everyone, I think, would agree with that. I think for the time being, I think if France don't go down to 14 men, I can see that being maybe a 10 to 12 point win for Ireland. I think they were a better team overall, but the 14 men definitely flatters Ireland to a degree. Let's talk about the Willemse yellow cards, the two yellow cards. I haven't seen really any pushback on this, which is great to see, because it was clearly two yellow cards, two brain dead yellow cards, especially the second one. To be that stupid to do the exact same thing that you've just done, whatever it was, 15, 20 minutes beforehand, you're going to get two yellow cards for that. And he cost his team in a big situation there. And he's going to be obviously very disappointed with himself in that too. I think even French fans I haven't seen online have been even given out about it, which is, again, kind of shows you how obvious it was that it was two yellows. It was. I think there's no argument with that, Westy, right?
No, I think I was quite, when we watched it live, I thought the first one was a bit harsh, but watching it back, you know, he isn't really in a realistic position. He dips late and makes contact with the head. So, yeah, fair enough. And again, even then, you make any contact with the head, you can't be surprised you get a yellow card, like, it just happens. And then I think they said that the second one was actually would have been upgraded to a red anyway. So I think I read that after the game. So, yeah, but, it, you know, it's one of those things where you get one yellow for high tackle, you think you'd be on your best behavior straight after, but unfortunately, Willemse just isn't. And look, it is obviously a pivotal moment in the game, especially losing the second row, losing something like their lineup. You know, our lineup was outstanding. So you lose somebody like that, it obviously contributes to kind of your set piece starting to wobble a little bit. It's already a kind of relatively changed French squad, even new 9-10 partnership, although they play together in Bordeaux, but they haven't played together at national level yet. I think it knocks your confidence. It's one of your big enforcers. There's a, you know, Paul Willemse is that type of player. He's a big, lofty second row. We see so many of them coming out of South Africa. He obviously has a role that involves his size and his physicality in that squad. And when you lose that, it can be as much a psychological blow as much as it is a physical blow. So I think while a red card, the two yellows rather, I should say, will be talked about, I don't think too many people are contesting either one of them. It's two instances of head contact. And I think no matter whether you agree or disagree with any decision made around it, if there is head contact, you open the door to be sent off. So you have to be extra careful if you get that first yellow. So, did it have a massive... I think we might have won either way. I think we were playing the better rugby. But definitely not by as much. And it definitely could have been a real nail biter had they stayed at 15.
Yeah, we asked Willemse to be on his best behaviour, but he promised someone else he'd be on his worst behaviour. So that's just the way it is. That's an Office reference there for you, Westy. You like that? I think Ireland now look ahead to, as I said, they welcome Italy this Sunday. Normally, that's when Jack Crowley would start or Ross Byrne would start because Sexton is there. But that's not happening now. I think We're not going to see much of a change in the 10 jersey. I assume Jack Crowley will just continue to start to get experience. Maybe Frawley comes in at full back. I was thinking maybe instead of Hugo, I think maybe you might rest other players now in situations. Maybe you give Bundy the weekend off. But I assume you're like me, you expect Jack Crowley to start 10.
Yeah. I expect him to stay 10 for the majority of the competition. Now you might see, did Frawley get 5 minutes or 3 minutes, I think, against France? You might see that change made slightly earlier against Italy. But I think it's important now for Crowley. Crowley is in possession of the jersey, as they say. It's important for Crowley to be given time to develop. You know, there's all these arguments made, oh, like Sexton had to take the jersey and whatever. Like, that's not always the case. We're in a situation now where we have a front runner who plays very well, who's young, who has so much potential. He is the 10 now until either him or someone else gives us reason to think otherwise. And the beauty of it is he is still young. He's around the same age Sexton was when he first came into Ireland camp. And Ireland wasn't revolutionized overnight either. Came to Ireland camp, but became kind of a stable in the Ireland squad. So it's important that he be given these games to grow and develop. And I think with a player like Crowley, we will see him come on leaps and bounds now in that position. And a game like the Italy game just gets him more comfortable, maybe with a different combination. Maybe Craig Casey starts that game and Crowley gets used to it. Well, he plays him in Munster, of course, but gets used to maybe Stuart McCluskey playing at 12 inside him, or some other combination, some other rotation, a different eight, a different different set of partnership, different fullback. Because, I mean, that was the beauty of Sexton, was that the other partnerships fit around him in a lot of ways. So it'll be interesting now to see. I think, yeah, Crowley is probably likely to start, touch wood, likely to start most of the Six Nations games, not all of them. But we will probably see, again, like Farrell's not one to dole out caps for no reason, but we might see changes made earlier and different combinations tried out in the early game, I'd say.
Is there a 5%, was there 5% of Johnny Sexton that was hoping for a France win on Friday night? I'm just being like, just on a human level, you know? To beat them by 21 points away from home, kind of like, probably not Sexton's ideal result.
His Racing jersey on, I'd say, watching that one.
Just shouting Alele Blue at the TV. I'm just joking, of course, but I'm sure, like, on a human level, I'm sure he would have liked to see a bit more of a struggle.
It's like any of us in any sport, like, so you always want your team to do well, but like when you come off injured and the team start playing 10 times better, you're like, oh shit, I hope no one else notices that.
Maybe it was me the whole time.
Yeah.
I'm joking, of course. But I thought, the just on Sexton, the documentary, I thought it showed him in a good light, a bit more of a human, maybe, as maybe some of us didn't get to see, which was nice. But quickly look ahead to this weekend. Scotland hosts France on Saturday at 2:15. I think people might write off France a bit too early here. As I said, the result was flattering to Ireland. They didn't play great last year against us as well, and then they ran off, you know, they bet all other teams pretty convincingly. So I wouldn't be writing them off yet. Scotland will be looking as a potential scalp here, but I still think France will have too much and a bit of a backlash. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's important to remember as well, the first game of the Nations last year was France-Italy, and again, Italy were that close to beating them. Like, France is hardly, don't start this competition very well, they grow into it. So, yeah, I definitely wouldn't be writing him off at all. I haven't seen Willemse, if he's banned or what the situation is there, but I mean, they have strong reserves in the second row, so I'm sure they won't worry too much. It's a big reaction needed from both teams, right? They both come out from slightly different angles, but that's what's needed now, is a big reaction to how the other game's finished. As I would say, Scotland beat France just before the World Cup. It was a very heavy rotated France team, but they still will go into this thinking that they can win, and they're at home in Murrayfield. So, I think there'll be a big France backlash, and I think they'll come out strong. Scotland have a lot to lose as well. If they lose this one after such a poor second half, as we said already, it could be very damaging for the rest of their campaign.
Yeah, just last thing on France, I think we've seen the big effect not having DuPont on that French team. Losing Ntamack is one thing, and it definitely impacts the team, but DuPont is a different level. I think we saw that against Ireland. Now, whether that will make a difference for the rest of the games, who knows, but just wanted to mention that as well. England then host Wales at the 4:45 kickoff. I have really no idea who's going to win this game, because I really don't think England are great. They are probably going to be tough to beat, but again, if that Welsh team from the second half shows up, anything's possible. But if we were trying to predict the score for this, I wouldn't know where to start. What's your kind of thoughts on this?
I kind of think it's maybe a 5 or 7 point game to England. I think Twickenham will put them up a level or two, just like I think when Wales scored 2 tries the weekend and the crowd in the Millennium Stadium got behind them. That's a huge, huge factor in the game. So, as was Ireland silencing the Velodrome in Marseille in a France game. So England will hopefully be a little more comfortable, probably be a little bit more cohesive than we saw them last week. But yeah, you've got Wales coming in kind of, although they lost, they're still coming in the crest of a wave. They're still coming in quite confident. And again, I said it before the tournament, I think this Wales team are going to be the most interesting to watch because I just don't know what to expect from them. But yeah, another game, a bit of confidence. I think England will get it on the home advantage. And maybe the scare they had last week against Italy at times. But yeah, Wales is never an easy game. There's always bitter rivalry between Wales and England as well. So I think it could be a very close one.
And then finally, Sunday, 3 o'clock, Ireland hosts Italy. I don't think there's much to be said about this game. More just, do we see a bit of rotation from Ireland? Again, probably a handful, you know, two or three players max. We don't tend to see it, but a bit interesting to just see how Ireland performs. The last couple of years, they haven't really performed in all cylinders against lower-level teams like Italy compared to the France and South Africa's. So, interesting to see how they handle that. But do you expect anything shocking here?
No, I think if Italy played the way they played at the weekend in Rome, we should win. I think if they are a team in development, they are going to improve. There is going to be one or two changes and differences in Italy to other years. But with the way we played at the weekend, with the way we've been playing for the last, you know, what have we won, 18 out of 17 games in the last 2 years, however long it is, I don't know. I think in Dublin, we should be expecting to win. We should be expecting to win well. I think we should be slightly cautious, because that attitude is dangerous. But yeah, I think we're good enough to win it. We're at home. And yeah, even with rotations, you think that we should, even if we're given a scare early on or at halftime, we should have enough in the tank to get the job done. I think that's one of the really impressive things about this Ireland team, is bar one shining example, we've always kind of been able to get it done.
Yeah, we don't like to talk about that example. all right, Wesley, that's brilliant. We will wrap it up there. As I said before, join our Six Nations Fantasy League. It's a bit of crack and good bragging rights, and me and Wesley will try and claw our way up the table this weekend. And yeah, we'll be back next week to recap round two. Unfortunately, Sam couldn't join us today, but he'll be back, I'm sure, next week then as well. So, Wesley, appreciate it, buddy. Catch you next week.
Cheers, man. See you next week. Bye.